Good afternoon, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, brought to you in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken, down here in rainy Missouri, reading from the Friday, April 26th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And now we'll have our first piece from above the fold of page one. New Iowa law to target illegal immigration. Local officials said they remain uncertain about the potential impacts of a new Iowa law that makes illegal immigration a state crime. The legislation provides law enforcement the ability to charge individuals currently in the U.S. illegally with an aggravated misdemeanor if they previously have been deported, denied admission, or removed from the country, or have an order to leave the U.S. The changes increase to Class D or C felonies under certain parameters. The law, which is similar to a Texas law currently being challenged in federal court, is set to go into effect July 1. Under the legislation, Iowa judges will be permitted to order the deportation of individuals who are in the U.S. illegally, and law enforcement can transport them to U.S. ports of entry. Local officials said they still mostly are unsure of how the law will impact law enforcement and prosecutions. Dubuque County Sheriff Joe Kennedy said he does not know if the law will change operations in his department. He said he thinks putting local law enforcement in charge of deportations is not the best use of taxpayer dollars, but added that it is unclear how the state plans to roll out the law. There are a lot of things that need to be fully understood before we can see how department procedures will change, if at all, he said. Dubuque County Attorney Scott Nelson said the new law focuses specifically on individuals who are living in the U.S. illegally, have been deported, and then come back. He said the law appears to be aimed at people who have committed crimes in the U.S. and fled to their home country to avoid prosecution before returning again. It is more of a deterrent to make people stay and deal with the crimes they are accused of instead of going home, he said. Area lawyer Catherine Caitlin practices immigration law in immigration courts in Nebraska, Illinois, and Minnesota, and said she feels the law is extreme and anti-immigration. She said local police have worked hard to develop good relationships with area immigrants and that she believes the law will erode those connections. We want immigrants to come to the police for help, she said. We want everyone to be safe, and if there's fear amongst them that doing so will cause them to be deported and torn away from their family, then I don't think they're going to approach law enforcement. Caitlin said immigration law is complicated, and the new Iowa law leaves much to interpretation. She said some of her clients have orders of removal currently being appealed and questions whether they will lose their right to appeal under the new law. Some individuals, she said, might have received orders of removal several years ago, but since have returned with new rights to residency in Iowa, such as getting married, seeking asylum, or having an adult U.S. citizen child. I don't think that there's any understanding at the state level how immigration works and the nuances, which there's many. So it's a very dull blade to slice off a big chunk, she said. Megan Ruiz, executive director of Presentation Lantern Center in Dubuque, which provides hospitality, education, and advocacy to adult immigrants, said in an emailed statement that refugees and immigrants in Iowa communities are essential to filling jobs in industries experiencing labor shortages. Ruiz said that in her experience, immigrants in Dubuque are hardworking people who simply want to build a life of their own in the U.S. If some bills proposed this year just adds unnecessary fear and anxiety and headaches to people who are just trying to work, including immigrants escaping war or poverty, she said. Iowa Representative Steve Bradley, Republican Cascade, said he fully supported the bill because it is aimed at individuals who have broken the law multiple times by entering the U.S. illegally more than once. He said his constituents lobbied for the law and that a trip he took to the U.S. southern border reinforced to him that the legislation was a necessary step. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said the law will prompt more deportations, of which she believes the federal government has not done enough. The Biden administration has failed to enforce our nation's immigration laws, putting the protection and safety of Iowans at risk, Reynolds said in a news release when she signed the bill into law. Those who come into our country illegally have broken the law, yet President Joe Biden refuses to deport them. According to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the agency deported more than 140,000 migrants from across the U.S. in fiscal year 2023, almost double the number of removals from the previous year. Iowa Representative Lindsey James, a Democrat, Dubuque, expressed frustration about federal politics influencing statewide policies. She said she believes Republican legislators should have been calling Iowa's congressional members to act instead of arguing about immigration at the state level. Dubuque has done a tremendous job welcoming people into our community and helping them make a home here, she said. To see families experiencing fear that their families are going to be torn apart in the immigration process breaks my heart. Our next front page piece. County adding to its efforts in opioid response. The Dubuque County Public Health Department's opioid response has crossed some early milestones as a new task force is set to start meeting next week. During a Dubuque County Board of Health meeting this week, Public Health Project Coordinator Carissa Brown unveiled a new website detailing where people can locate the opioid overdose antidote naloxone drop boxes for disposing of sharps and opiate medications and other services. Brown also recently provided her first naloxone administration instruction and distribution as a certified secondary distributor. Other planned opioid response programs are still being developed, nearly a year after area advocates called for urgency in the county's use of more than $500,000 from settlements of lawsuits against opioid manufacturers, a fund total expected to continue growing in the coming years. Brown was hired in November to lead efforts in how best to use the settlement funds. Since then, she has secured the certifications necessary to distribute naloxone, researched programs, and strategies being pursued by other counties, and compiled a list of currently available resources. The health department's new role as a secondary distributor of naloxone from its offices at the county's West Campus, 1225 Sipal Road, has the potential to be a major step in the county's efforts to fight the opioid epidemic, Brown said. But she said not many people have used the service yet, as it is not well known. People can come to me, learn from me how to administer it, she said. Then I can give them a case of the naloxone. Now, it's about promoting that we have it here and that they can come to me for it. Our other idea is me going to community events where we can provide that service or spread the news. Brown also has compiled maps of naloxone distributors across the county on a new opioid response dashboard accessible via the health department's homepage at DubuqueCountyIowa.gov/223/health-department. If you click on a locations icon, it shows you where it's at, when it's open, the number to call, a link to their website, Brown said. The website also features a map of lockboxes that contain clean supplies and educational information so people using substances can take what they need on their own terms, according to the site. These lockboxes are another of the department's strategies and are used in communities around the country. The website also includes a maps of drop boxes, pain management services for those seeking alternatives to opioids, treatment providers, and mental health recovery services. Brown sent surveys and reached out to known providers of each mapped service, but said she knows the website is not comprehensive yet. It will forever be growing, changing, and updating with more organizations, information, and resources, Brown told the Board of Health. But we wanted to get something out there where people can go to if they're looking for prevention, treatment, alternative methods to assist them. It will be updated quarterly-ish with different numbers to reflect what's going on. Board of Health Chair Amy Crow Sunleaf invited county residents' input on services and locations missing from the website. "I pushed really hard for this to get online, knowing it's not perfect," she said. "Now we can have this discussion because we're all at the same table. The more businesses and providers who see this, the better." The website prominently features year-to-date overdose data at the national, state, and county levels on its landing page. Dubuque County Supervisor Ann McDonough, the Board of Supervisors liaison to the Board of Health, said she would like the site to be more easily navigated by people in crisis. "If I'm a parent and I'm concerned, or I'm a spouse looking for resources, and this website is where I land, I think we need some connectors to get them to information fast," she said. Brown said she would work on making the site more crisis-focused. The Board of Health's biggest opioid response plan so far includes installing public naloxone boxes around the county. But Brown said numerous considerations, including that naloxone needs to be kept cool and that not all the county's communities have the same needs, require more planning for that method to be realized. "Planning for these naloxone boxes will be the top priority for a stakeholder group, including Board of Health members, healthcare providers, Dubuque Harm Reduction, substance use treatment providers, law enforcement, and others, which begins meeting next week." The Opioid Response website also includes a counter of opioid overdoses in Dubuque County so far this year. According to the site, there have been 4 individuals who have overdosed in the county this year, as counted by the Dubuque Drug Task Force. McDonough said the site should clarify the source of that data because other stakeholders disagree with how the Dubuque Drug Task Force counts overdoses. Drug Task Force Sergeant Adam Williams said the group's metric for counting overdoses only includes people who recover after law enforcement administers naloxone or whose post-mortem toxicology report finds evidence of opioid use. Now we have our third and final front page piece, which comes with a picture. The picture has a red background, and it looks like there are a number of theater seats with a gentleman in a poised position speaking to a number of people in those theater seats. And beneath it, the caption reads, "H. Nelson Tracy, Director of the film Breakup Season answers questions after a showing of his film at Phoenix Theaters during the Julian Dubuque International Film Festival on Thursday. And our article is Julian Dubuque International Film Festival. Filmmakers bring first features to Dubuque Film Festival. Two feature-length films making their Iowa premieres at this week's Julian Dubuque International Film Festival are from writer-directors who took huge leaps of faith to bring their screenplays to life. H. Nelson Tracy, 31, is a Denver, Colorado native who came of age in Los Angeles. Tracy's film, Breakup Season, made its world premiere at Desertscape International Film Festival in St. George, Utah, where it took home awards for Best Feature, Audience Choice, Best Ensemble, and Best Actress, Samantha Isler. "I've done short films," Tracy said, "but it's a big budget leap to a feature. This film was born out of a love for film festivals." The film was shot on location in La Grande, Oregon, over a three-week period, and Tracy had help with funding from Eastern Oregon Film Festival. Tracy also participated in the organization's filmmaker residency program. "I had traveled to the festival with a short documentary that I directed," he said. "That's how I got plugged into La Grande. Otherwise, I would never have gone there for a film shoot." During the filmmaker residency, Tracy was working on another screenplay, but the landscape of rural Oregon got him thinking about Breakup Season, an idea he had had for over a decade but had never committed to the page. Breakup Season tells the story of Ben and Cassie, a 20-something couple, in a serious relationship. Ben brings Cassie to rural Oregon to meet his family and to celebrate the holidays. But when Cassie breaks up with Ben and winter weather keeps her from leaving, things get awkward for everyone. Once the screenplay was complete, Tracy thought rural Oregon would be a perfect location shoot. Eastern Oregon with Film Festival became a fiscal sponsor, serving as a central source for those wanting to make smaller donations to help fund the film. Tracy also sent out hundreds of emails to raise corporate sponsorships and took out a small personal loan to cover the balance of the film's budget. "Eastern Oregon Film Festival gave us a lot of credibility," he said. "It wasn't just Nelson is making a movie. The film festival was an organization who had seen promise in a filmmaker, and the town really opened their doors to us." Kit Rich, 41, is a Los Angeles native who always dreamed of writing but never thought she was good enough. Her writing and directorial debut is Isabel's Garden. "My father was a producer, and I saw how tough that business was," she said. "I was a playwright, and I just kept getting rejected. I was in my 20s and vulnerable and insecure. I wish I'd had the confidence to not take no for an answer." Instead, Rich became a Pilates trainer and quickly amassed a clientele of A-list movie and music stars. "The Pilates just took off," she said. "I had this feeling, where writing was concerned, I had given up on myself, and it was too late." During the COVID-19 pandemic, Rich wrote a play that she quickly realized should be a movie. She recrafted it into a screenplay, and Isabel's Garden was born. The film tells the story of Maya, an up-and-coming broadcast reporter who has the perfect life and a perfect script for her future. But when her husband is killed in a crash, Maya finds herself co-parenting Isabel, her teen stepdaughter, with her husband's ex-wife. Soon, Maya finds her future plans turned upside down. Rich admits she was lucky enough to have some connections to get the script to the point where it could be made, but nobody wanted to attach themselves to the film as a director. So she took on that task herself. "I was so naive," she said, But I read books, looked on YouTube. My director of photography, Andrew Fonsack, was so incredible. He taught me so much. Isabel's Garden was a 15-day shoot with 172 scenes and 8 locations, all shot with a single camera. "That's nuts," Rich said. "Couple that with the fact that I'm a first-timer, and that was scary for everybody." Isabel's Garden debuted at Poppy Jasper International Film Festival in Morgan Hill, California, at the beginning of April, where it garnered the award for Best Feature. Rich also won the Audience Award for Best Writing. Tracy, who was able to snag some top-tier talent in actors Chandler Riggs and Samantha Isler, and in character actor James Urbaniak, had a dream the night before shooting began that he said set the tone for him for the whole shoot. "You could call it a nightmare," he said. "You could call it a warning. I dreamed that I yelled at everyone. It was a really important dream to have because I knew that no matter what crazy madness we ran into, I had to be calm and I had to be kind because everyone was doing me a solid." Rich said, or still rather, is working as a Pilates trainer and is honest about the fact that Isabel's Garden is a baby step toward transitioning full-time into the entertainment space. She credits her parents with giving her the skill and the moxie to take that path. "I inherited my writing from my mom," she said. "But what I inherited from my dad was his bravery. He would take risks and apologize later. And he always said, never be swayed by the nays or the praise. That was the biggest thing he taught me." We have one small inset still on page one. We have a crane, which is obviously by the Dubuque Brewing and Malting Company. And the brief piece says, "Demolition still brewing. Demolition crews remove a large decorative logo at the Dubuque Brewing and Malting Company building on Thursday. City officials said crews discovered more asbestos that had to be removed. Today, crews plan to remove sections of the building on 30th Street that have already collapsed, and major demolition is expected to start Monday, April 29th. Now we turn to our page for Dubuque and Tri-State News, and we'll pick up our first piece, Platteville Council, No Exemption for Grant County Humane Society. A Southwest Wisconsin animal shelter is responsible for paying over $16,000 in property taxes on the building it purchased last year, the Platteville Common Council decided this week. Grant County Humane Society is a tax-exempt nonprofit. However, the property it purchased in May 2023 at 500 East U.S. Business 151 in Platteville was not previously tax-exempt, according to Platteville Council documents. The Humane Society closed on the property after March 1, 2023, which made it ineligible for property tax exemption in 2024, documents state. The Humane Society asked the council to waive its 2024 tax bill. Organization leaders say they were unaware the nonprofit would owe the taxes and said they were never informed about it. The council denied that request this week in a 6-1 vote, with council member Ken Killian dissenting. "I think that there was knowledge missing at the time that those discussions took place, which was the law related to transfer of ownership of a property," Nicola Maurer, Platteville Administration Director, said at the council meeting. "The state statutes do specify that humane societies are property tax exempt, but they cannot be property tax exempt in the year in which they take ownership of a commercial property if the ownership transition is after March 1st. The Humane Society purchased its new 11,000-square-foot building last year, both to relocate and expand from its current location at Lancaster Veterinary Clinic. Carrie Schaefer, Humane Society Board President, said in an interview that throughout multiple meetings with Platteville Common Council and committees, including the city's Plan Commission and Frederick Animal Care Trust Fund Committee, no one indicated the nonprofit would need to pay property taxes on its new building this year. "We're not trying to get away from it. We just didn't know," she said. She said, "It is an expensive lesson learned, but now that the council made its decision, the Humane Society will pay the bill as soon as it can." After raising funds to purchase the building, the Humane Society now is funding for the renovation of the new space and the shelter's eventual move. The goal is to raise $850,000 for the renovation and over $200,000 for an operating fund. So far, Schaefer said the organization has raised about $50,000 for the renovation and has about $23,000 in the operating fund. Through outreach and several upcoming events, she hopes to raise enough to begin renovations at the start of 2025. Killian said at the council meeting that upon reading a Humane Society letter sent to the council requesting the taxes be waived, it seemed the Humane Society was misled by city officials. Maurer said she disagreed with Killian's assessment and believes the Humane Society officials misunderstood details or did not have all the information about the situation. Common Council member Todd Casper said the city supports the mission of the Humane Society but cannot write off taxes for local entities. He added that it is not the city's responsibility to inform businesses of tax laws. "Unfortunately, we love the Humane Society, but we can't make an exception here without making an exception for every taxed entity," he said. Now we'll take a look at our view on the opinion page, which represents the viewpoints of the Telegraph Herald editorial board. And today we have a singular piece, JDIFF showcases all kinds of storytellers. Local residents looking for something to do don't have to look far to find an area buzzing with activity this week. Julian Dubuque International Film Festival is back and in full swing. And you don't have to be a filmmaker or even a movie buff to enjoy the goings-on. Sure, several dozen people involved in filmmaking attend the annual event. And festival, which began Wednesday and continues through Sunday, April 28th, they will be around town, networking, presenting programs, interacting with audience members, watching their peers' productions, and maybe even scouting locations for future films. Though international is in the event's name, and though there will be filmmakers from many other countries joining Americans in attendance, this is a community event. Everyone is welcome. In its 13th year, with Executive Director Susan Gorell at the helm for the past 10 years, Julian Dubuque International Film Festival has grown exponentially and shows no signs of slowing down. 9 years ago, during Gorell's first year heading up the festival, JDIFF received 186 film submissions. 55 of those were chosen to be screened at the festival. This year, 1,100 submissions were received. Dozens of volunteer screeners viewed and critiqued the films, and 160 films will be shown. Not sure where to start? Try taking in a short block, a collection of short films shown back-to-back at one of various locations downtown. Or head to Five Flags Theater at 7 p.m. tonight for the world premiere of Camera, where director Jave Silverman and actor Miguel Gabriel will be in attendance at the screening. The film also features Beau Bridges. TH reporter Michelle London has previewed multiple films, and you can catch up on her stories, including her interview with Bridges, at telegraphherald.com. The blending of the arts and community is the reason why the TH Media again is committing substantial resources to the festival. It's a quality event. Don't ask us, ask the filmmakers how this festival compares to others they attend, and the TH is proud to have it taking place in Dubuque. A complete guide to the films and events can be viewed at julianfilmfestival.com. The bevy of genres include documentary, feature, short, animation, comedy, drama, family, horror, international, musical, mystery, romance, sci-fi, and thriller, as well as featuring future filmmakers, short blocks, and student spotlights. Unlike some fine arts experiences, where if you don't make it to the art museum or library today, you can go tomorrow or next week, this huge festival is a limited engagement. It comes around just once a year, and this is its time. So make time, and let's roll out a warm tri-state area welcome for the many visitors the festival brings. Check out the 13th Annual Julian Dubuque International Film Festival and enjoy the show. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, brought to you in part by Dupaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken, and I am reading from the Friday, April 26th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And we now turn to today's obituaries. Lois M. Hiring, Belmont, Wisconsin. Lois M. Hiring, age 89, of Belmont, passed away with her family by her side on April 14th at Bethany Home in Dubuque. Lois was born in Cuba City, Wisconsin, on May 27, 1934, to Vincent and Dolores Fulmer Hutiger. She attended grade school in a one-room schoolhouse, Vickers School, and then went on to graduate from Belmont High School. Lois moved to Dubuque, where she attended Bayless Business College in Dubuque, and then proceeded to work at Coca-Cola as an office manager for 4 years. She was very proud to be a single working woman in the early 1950s, because very few women did in those days. During this time, she lived at Mary Queen of Angels, a boarding house for women, and loved to tell stories of her time there. After many dances at the Melody Mill, Lois married the love of her life, Ed Hiring, on August 22, 1956, at St. Peter's Catholic Church, Elk Grove, Wisconsin. Lois and Ed raised their 5 children on the family farm outside of Belmont. Lois was always by Ed's side, helping in the barn, assisting with field work, along with cooking, summer gardening, and canning. Lois was also a very skilled and talented seamstress and baker. She is best known for her homemade pies and various breads. She passed down her love of growing flowers to her daughters and grandchildren. She found joy in feeding and watching the birds. She and Ed spent many summers fishing in northern Wisconsin and handed down her fishing tips onto her children and grandchildren. Even though Lois and Ed were not able to dance much in their later years, Lois loved big band music and dancing to a good waltz. For many years, Lois was part of the Homemakers Club, and for over 50 years, Lois and Ed were members of several card clubs. They also enjoyed going for drives in the country and stopping for an ice cream cone. Lois believed in giving back to her community. She volunteered her time with her church, the Belmont School and Community Fair, Pleasant View 4-H Club, and the Belmont Historical Society. After retiring from the farm, Lois worked part-time at Land's End for 10 years. Lois was a long-standing faithful member of St. Philomena Catholic Church. Most importantly, Lois will be remembered for her dedication to her husband, caring for him through his many years of health issues. Ed always said Lois was the best nurse he could ever have had. Mass of Christian burial will be at noon, Saturday, April 27th, at St. Philomena Catholic Church, Belmont. Burial will be at Resurrection Cemetery, Belmont. Visitation will be from 9:30 a.m. to 11:45 a.m. at the church. The Melby Funeral Home and Crematory, Platteville, is serving the family. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to a local food pantry in Lois's memory. A memorial fund has also been established in Lois's name. Online condolences can be made at www.melbyfh.com. Barbara J. Burroughs, Galena. Barbara J. Glasgow Burroughs, 86, of Galena, passed away Monday, April 22nd at the Midwest Senior Care Community in Galena. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, May 4th at the Miller Funeral Home in East Dubuque, where family and friends may call after 9:30 a.m. on Saturday. Reverend Jim McCray will officiate. Burial will follow in Greenwood Cemetery, Galena. Barbara was born on November 6, 1937, in Galena, the daughter of William and Myrtle Sertle Harris. She was united in marriage to Foster D. Jr. Glasgow on May 11, 1957, at First Presbyterian Church in Galena. He preceded her in death on December 20, 1983. She later married William D. Bill Burroughs on March 14, 1987, at St. Francis de Sales Church in Hazel Green. He preceded her in death on May 22, 2015. Barb was a graduate of Galena High School, class of 1951. Right out of high school, she was employed as a phone operator at Illinois Bell. She then went to work at Galena Stouse Hospital, Joe Davies County Health Department, the Owners Club at the Galena Territory, Honest John's with her grandson Kevin, and Country Cast. As a kid, she was known as Bootsy. Later in life, we called her Busy Barb because she could never sit still. If you drove on Dodge Street, you could always find her with a broom or a rake in her hand. Or you might catch her taking a break, sitting on the porch with a smile and a wave. Barb was one of the kindest souls you could meet. If it made a difference, she'd give a stranger her last nickel. She loved playing the slots. She may have come home with less in her pocket, but she always had a great time. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.millerfhed.com. Merlin J. McDermott, Cascade. Merlin J. Whiskers McDermott, 82, of Cascade, passed away Tuesday, April 23rd at Unity Point Finley Hospital in Dubuque, surrounded by his family. The family of Merlin will greet friends and relatives from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Saturday at the Rife Funeral Home in Cascade, where a service will be held at 11 a.m. with Reverend Thomas McDermott officiating. Burial will be held at a later date. Merlin was born February 5, 1942, in Cascade, son of Lewis and Irene Horsfield McDermott. He received his education at the former St. Martin's School in Cascade. Whiskers served in the National Guard. He then owned and operated Whiskers Electric for 42 years. He served in the Army National Guard and was a member of the Cascade American Legion Post No. 528. Whiskers loved stock car racing and won many championships. He's in the Dubuque Speedway Hall of Fame. His other favorite activities included woodworking, gardening, cutting firewood, playing euchre. He was known for his generous spirit and helping family, friends, and strangers alike. Whiskers will be greatly missed by his family and friends. He was also a member of the Cascade American Legion Post No. 528. An online video may be viewed and online condolences may be sent to the family at www.rifefuneralhomeinc.com. Clayton L. Griebel, Maquoketa. Clayton Griebel, 64, of Iowa City, formerly of Maquoketa, passed away peacefully Sunday, April 21st, at Windmill Manor in Coralville. A visitation will be held on Tuesday, April 30th, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the First Lutheran Church in Maquoketa. His service will be at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, April 30th, at First Lutheran Church. Burial will be at St. John Lutheran Cemetery in St. Donatus. To view his full obituary or leave an online condolence, please visit www.dawsonfuneral.com. Inez D. Nutt, Madison. Inez D. Nutt, 87, of Madison and formerly of Dubuque, died Tuesday, April 23rd. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, April 30th, and at 8:30 a.m. Wednesday, May 1st at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Services will take place at 10 a.m. Wednesday at Sacred Heart Catholic Church. Wilbert E. Post, Potosi. Wilbert E. Post, 93, of Potosi, died on Tuesday, April 23rd. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, April 30th at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Potosi, where services will follow. Burial will take place in British Hollow Cemetery in Potosi. Karen M. Smith, Monticello. Karen M. Smith, 77, of Monticello, formerly of Dubuque and Farley, passed away on Sunday, April 21st at Monticello Nursing and Rehab Center in Monticello. Visitation for Karen will be held from 10 a.m. to noon on Friday, April 26th at the Rife Funeral Home in Epworth. Services for Karen will be held at noon on Friday, April 26th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Epworth, with Reverend David Ambrose presiding. Assisting Deacon will be Nick Elliott. Burial will be held at St. Patrick's Cemetery in Epworth. Karen was born March 28, 1947, in Farley, Iowa, daughter of Leroy and Anna Marie Stephan Smith. She went on to work at the Dubuque Opportunity Center, Garfield Opportunity Center, Mercy Hospital, Dubuque Inn, and St. Patrick's Lunch Program, all in Dubuque, Iowa. Karen loved embroidering, puzzles, playing kings and corners, and Chinese checkers. She had a wonderful sense of humor and always had jokes. She is survived by four siblings. David A. Ryder. David A. Ryder, 65, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, April 24th. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. Monday, April 27th, at Eaglehoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road, where services will follow. Lexa I. Broadbeck. Lexa I. or L. Broadbeck, 71, of Dubuque, died Friday, April 12th. Visitation will be held from 10 a.m. to noon, Saturday, April 27th, at Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville, Wisconsin, where services will follow. With these passings, we remember also those who have newly arrived, and we have just a couple. So our births are Monday, April 22nd, Collister, Zach and Megan Collister of Maquoketa, a boy at Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center. And Thursday, April 25th, Thenn, Tyler and Kelsey Thenn of Epworth, Iowa, a boy at Mercy One. Blessings to both of you little ones, and may life be fulfilled. Now, find another piece of our Dubuque news. UD grad blends passions for aviation, health, and music. From flying airplanes to leading a marching band and teaching yoga classes, Delano Kane Watson has done a bit of everything during his time at University of Dubuque. UD has given me the chance to grow in all my passions and my interests, said Kane Watson, 23, who will graduate from UD on Saturday with a major in aviation management and minors in human health science and African American studies. Kane Watson was born in Chicago. His mother died when he was six, and he lived with various family members for the next few years before moving to Dubuque when he was 13. Since then, he has lived in Dubuque with his adoptive father, Charles Barland, a professor of music at UD, and he still maintains close ties with his biological family in Chicago, but considers Dubuque his hometown. He enrolled at UD intending to study something in the medical field, as he always had an interest in holistic health. He's a licensed massage therapist and Reiki master teacher and owns Eterna Wellness Company, which offers yoga classes and others. So it was a surprise, even for him, when he found himself an aviation management major after his friend introduced him to the program. On the south side of Chicago, there was not a whole bunch of representation of pilots in my community, he said. I didn't know even one black pilot, and it wasn't something I even or ever had my eye on. But he quickly fell in love with aviation. And this year, he was president of UD's Aviation Without Borders Club and helped bring a chapter of National Gay Pilots Association to campus. Kane Watson soon realized he could blend his passions for health and aviation. As founding president of UD's Holistic Health Club, he offered yoga classes and educational events on campus, often specifically reaching out and to invite his aviation classmates. He also nurtured his love of music by serving as one of the first drum majors of UD's marching band, founded in 2022. In the fall, he will attend Phoenix Institute of Herbal Medicine and Acupuncture to pursue his doctorate in herbal medicine and acupuncture. He hopes to specialize in treating dermatological conditions and mental health and would like one day to advocate for mental health access in the aviation industry. Now we have some of our news in brief. Man stole thousands of dollars worth of jewelry from mother. Police said a Dubuque man stole thousands of dollars worth of jewelry from his mother. Douglas F. Winner, 51, of 1626 Butterfield Road, was arrested at 10:11 p.m. Wednesday at his residence on a charge of first-degree theft against an older individual. Court documents state that Winner's mother, a Dubuque resident, contacted police on March 29th to report the theft of at least 17 pieces of jewelry with an estimated value of $35,300. The woman was not certain when the theft occurred, but the police investigation showed the jewelry was taken at least between January 2023 and March 29th, documents state. Winner had a key to the apartment and began visiting his mother with regularity at the same time she noticed pieces of jewelry were missing, documents state. The woman confronted Winner about the missing jewelry, and he admitted to taking some jewelry to local pawn shops, documents state. Police followed up with local pawn shops and found Winner had made at least 17 jewelry sales to Allied Pawn and Jerry's Pawn during the time frame of the thefts, documents state. The police investigation also determined that Winner had lost $4,403 since January 2023 at local casinos. Documents state that most of the woman's jewelry purchased paperwork is missing, but police were able to locate appraisals for some of the missing items. These items were appraised for more than $18,000. Police began attempting to contact Winner on April 16th, but were unsuccessful. A warrant was issued for Winner's arrest on Tuesday. Fayette Police Chief poised to take similar post in Manchester. The police chief of Fayette, Iowa, is poised to replace the retiring police chief of Manchester. Ben Davis will be appointed to the position of mayor, to the position by Mayor Connie Benkin, according to city manager Tim Vick. Vick wrote in an email to the Telegraph Herald that the appointment will be made upon completion of a background check. The Manchester City Council then could approve the appointment at its meeting May 13th. It is anticipated that once this is done, Mr. Davis will start with the City of Manchester on May 28th, Vick wrote. Davis will replace retiring Chief Jim Hauschild. Hauschild's last day with the city will be May 31st. He has served with the department for 30 years and became chief in May 2014. Davis was one of three finalists for the position. The others were Chad Wright, a captain with Manchester Police, and Scott Birch, the police chief of Sheldon, Iowa. Davis told the Manchester Press that he had served in the U.S. Air Force for 6 years and began his civilian police career in 2014. He has been chief in Fayette for the last 7 years. Authorities. Worthington house fire caused $200,000 in damage. Authorities said a house fire caused $200,000 in damage in Dubuque County, though no injuries were reported. The Dubuque County Sheriff's Department and Worthington and Dyersville Fire Departments responded to a fire at approximately 4:50 p.m. Wednesday at 308 First Street South in Worthington, according to a press release issued by the Sheriff's Department. The release states that the fire began on the rear porch before spreading to the house. An investigation revealed that the fire likely was caused by an electrical issue with the porch lighting. Dubuque County Sheriff Joe Kennedy said there were no injuries reported. The The occupants stayed with relatives immediately after the fire. Sample ballots for June primary available in Dubuque County. Sample ballots for the June 4 primary election are available online for Dubuque County voters. Sample ballots can be found at elections.dubuquecountyiowa.gov. In-person early voting will begin May 15th at the election office, 880 Central Avenue. The Dubuque County Election Office will accept requests for absentee ballots through 5 p.m. on May 20th. Voters who want to receive a mailed ballot must complete a request form. Forms can be obtained online or by calling the election office at 563-589-4456. 10th Annual Cascade Wing Fest set for May 11th. Cascade Area Chamber of Commerce will hold the 10th Annual Cascade Wing Fest next month. The event will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. May 11th at Cascade Riverview Park, 101 Pierce Street Southwest. Area cooks will compete in a wing cook-off. Wings will be served while supplies last. Admission is free. Wing tasting tickets are $10 for 8 samples. Food and beverages are available for purchase. Live music will be performed by Mike Zelaznik. Future Fest planned at Multicultural Family Center. A free event in Dubuque aims to help high school students prepare for the transition to adulthood. Multicultural Family Center's Future Fest will take place from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, May 2nd at the center, 1157 Central Avenue, according to an online announcement. The event includes information on community resources, dinner, and a keynote address by author Little Joy and Harms. Harms, A Chance for a Better Life, Chosen but Hidden, is a personal story that tells of her journey through addiction, mental illness, and childhood trauma. Registration is not required. Vintage Torque Fest scheduled in Dubuque. An annual fundraising vintage car and motorcycle show will be held in Dubuque next week. Vintage Torque Fest will take place May 3 and 4 at the Dubuque County Fairgrounds. The show opens at noon on Friday, May 3rd, and at 9 a.m. on Saturday, May 4th. Cost is $20 per day or $35 for the weekend. Kids 12 and under are free, as are active military members with photo identification. The event also features live music and racing. The event raises money for the Helping Hannah's Heart Foundation, a nonprofit that benefits children with congenital heart disease and their families. For additional information, visit facebook.com/vintagetorquefest. Platteville man found guilty of battery. New diggings. A Platteville man has been found guilty of battery for assaulting a man who stabbed him. A Lafayette County jury recently found Emil L. Miser, 46, guilty of substantial battery with intent to cause bodily harm and disorderly conduct. The jury acquitted Meisen of a criminal property damage charge. A sentencing hearing has been set for June 17th. The charges stem from a 2021 altercation between Melson and Benjamin R. Everson, 36, then of Benton, Wisconsin. Court documents state Everson was sitting in his vehicle in New Diggings when Melson approached him. Melson told authorities Everson stabbed him, prompting him to punch Everson twice, documents state. Everson told authorities Melson struck him first, prompting him to stab Melson in self-defense. Melson was taken by ambulance to Southwest Health in Platteville, where he received stitches for a puncture wound to the bicep and was released. Everson previously was sentenced to 6 months in jail and 3 years of probation after entering a no-contest plea to charges of substantial battery, intend bodily harm, felony bail jumping, and criminal damage to property. Well, one other little nice personal piece, complete with pictures of a 1959 Ford Thunderbird in kind of a baby blue color. And the article is Dyersville Man Treasures 1959 Ford Thunderbird. For years, Dyersville's Bob and Grace Lee wintered in Texas. Upon returning home one March about 10 years ago, Bob was happily surprised to find a 1959 two-door Ford Thunderbird parked in his garage. Knowing his dad had been searching for just such a beauty, the Lee's son, Rob, found the vehicle in Chicago and purchased it. An undertaker in Chicago had it for years, Bob Lee said. The guy had a heart attack, so he sold it. Everything's original. Lee keeps the antique auto in beautiful condition, sometimes entering it in car shows. One year, I put in all new upholstery, front and back. The back was good because nobody sat in the back, but the front was getting frayed, he said. Lee's wife, Grace, drove the car for 3 or 4 years, but mostly drove her 1969 Buick, according to Lee. Grace died in February 2019, but Lee still has both cars. And while he drives both vehicles, Lee wraps the Thunderbird in a large protective zip-up cover and keeps it in storage at home during the winter. Once spring arrives, he takes the T-Bird out, repairs the things that need attention, and drives it weekly, mostly on car club outings in Dubuque. We go on a cruise every week, 10 to 15 cars every week, he said, before continuing. Most of the car clubs do that. They take their cars for a show and sit there and drink beer and look at their car. If you have a car, you drive it. Lee is preparing for this year's touring season, which begins in May. I got the speedometer cable out, and I got a new gasket under the oil pan, and I got a cracked driver's side window. I got to get them fixed. But Lee, now 85, is not sure how long he will keep driving the Thunderbird. It's too hard to get in and out of them old cars, he said. And because he keeps bias ply tires on the vehicle to stay consistent with the original equipment instead of modern radial tires, the ride is a little rougher. Those bias ply tires don't ride as good. They are not as smooth, he confesses. Now we have the weekend buzz, the noteworthy things to do this weekend, and we've got lots of them. Burgundy Waltz at the Riverboat Lounge, 7 to 10 p.m., live music from Burgundy Waltz at the historic hotel's Riverboat Lounge. Admission is free. Hard Salami at the Mississippi Moon Bar. Today, 8 p.m., the Dubuque-based interactive party band comes to perform at the Moon Bar to play good music badly. Must be 21 or older to attend. Admission is free. Julian Dubuque International Film Festival, closing weekend today through Sunday. Screenings begin at 10 a.m., and you can get tickets, $12 for adults.